Amateur Grammatics by Kevin Partner. Read by Kevin Partner. The old woman sat on the pebbles and gave the sea a good talking to. The locals had grown so used to her annual pilgrimage to the little town of Piddlin Sea that they hardly paid any attention. At least, that was the way their rational minds explained how it was that they routinely ignored the impossible taking place before their eyes. "Now then," said Grandma Tickle, resuming her decades-long tirade, "you owe me. I don't need to tell you that." "Oh, but you will," repeatedly. "And I ain't no old King Cole neither." The sea paused, contemplating this. "No, when I command the sea to go out, it bloody well goes out if it knows what's good for it."
"You mean King Canute? King Cole was the merry old soul."
The old woman shook her head.
"Well, I don't see how he'd have been so merry with wet feet. Anyway, hark on. Our Terence, he goes by Tez, is crossing the Doggerel Straits this autumn. And young Elasmus, he's with Captain Sherry on the Southern Ocean. A good lad, that Elas. He's promised me a new walking stick made out of ironwood. Now, have you got that? You're to keep my lads safe."
"I'm sure I'll remember. It's the same names every year. Tez Tickle and his brother Elas."
"'Cause don't you forget, I lost my Arthur 'cause of you."
"How could I forget a lost particle?"
The pebbles grumbled as the old woman made herself comfortable. A gregarious crab, footnote, the showy extrovert cousin of the hermit crab, pulled itself from the wreckage, peered out from under the whelk it was currently calling home, and gave a wave. After a few moments, Grandma felt herself sink a little, as a dozen or so mollusk-based dwellings detached themselves from the beach and trundled grumpily towards the waterline.
"Ta-ra, Cockle," said Grandma,
as the sad little procession neared the sea.
"And Winkle."
The old woman stretched her legs. To either side of her, the incoming tide had swamped the beach. But in her little area of influence, the sea had decided, from bitter experience, to wait for permission to come in. Grandma raised her gaze from the mollusk migration and fixed the sea with a stare. "I also hear tell you tried to claim a little puppy dog last week." Just for a moment, the waves seemed to stop rolling in.
"I didn't try to claim that mangy cur. When I claim things, I claim them."
"Don't you get arsy with me," said Grandma,
pointing a knobbly finger in the general direction of the ocean.
"I've seen what's left of the poor little thing after they've fished it out. The little girl what found it is inside herself with grief."
"But it wasn't me. I was minding my own business and the filthy creature landed in amongst me. It'll take weeks to get rid of the smell."
Grandma rested her head on her hand, in a pose that made her look more constipated than contemplative.
"So, if you didn't call the little wretch to its death, what happened?"
"I'll take a wild splash in the dark and suggest it was thrown off the pier."
"But why would anyone do that to a poor little doggie?"
"Have you smelled it?"
"Well, if everyone what smelled bad were to be drowned at sea..."
The old woman paused as the waves seemed to momentarily shudder at the prospect.
"I suppose the seaside would smell better, but it ain't really practical. I know a lad called Willie Clitheroe. Now, he reeks like something rotten, but it won't be his smell what gets him in trouble."
"What would it be, then?"
"It'll be because he's got the brains of a turnip and the self-control of a zombie in a brains factory."
Grandma settled back and looked up at the sky, seeming to barely notice the ridge of black clouds marching towards her.
"No, there's more to this than meets the eye. I wish young Jessie Hemlock were here. She's the faggler, not me."
The old woman hauled herself to her feet, causing a minor avalanche of pebbles. The top of a spiral shell poked out from the wreckage, and a tiny shape dragged itself clear, and with an almost audible tut, staggered to the waves.
"Right, Cock," Grandma said to the sea, "I'm off."
"Good."
Grandma turned to walk up the beach.
"And don't think I'm going because of that rainstorm yonder," she said, pointing up at the sky. "You can save yourself the effort tomorrow."
"Tomorrow?"
"Aye, I've got some thinking to do, but I ain't finished with you yet. See you, Cock. Don't go anywhere."
"Ha, ha."
Straightening herself as she reached the top of the stone steps onto the sea wall, Grandma glanced at the sea, which, it seemed, was pretending not to watch her. She chuckled to herself as she ambled across the cobbled street. For an elemental, there was nothing quite so satisfying as putting an element in its place. Other than, perhaps, a warm pint of stocky or winning an argument with Jesse Hemlock. Now there was a sharp mind, thought Grammer as she passed, absent-mindedly, in front of a mail coach that had moments before been travelling at breakneck speed. She was woken from her fagglings by the horse's warm breath, which had, having entered her left ear, encountered little resistance as it left her right. "All right, cock," she said, waving up to the coach driver, who sat white-faced and trembling, watching her pass. The driver nodded and forced his face into a smiling rictus as he held the reins in an iron grip. It would not do to run over a witch. Horses were expensive. Grammer renewed her contemplation as she stepped towards the far pavement, hardly noticing as the horses sprung away, setting a new but unofficial equine acceleration record. Jesse Hemlock. Yes, she'd know what to do. No one else in Pidlinsea seemed particularly bothered about what had happened to the dog, but Grammer knew that something was odd about it. The old woman believed the sea when it said it hadn't called the dog to it, and to be honest, it wouldn't have solved the mystery if it had. She would either have had to explain why the sea hadn't managed to claim the creature, or who had thrown it in. The real puzzle, though, was what had happened to the poor thing's mind. Now, Grammer accepted that she'd been at the back of the queue when the brains were being handed out, but even she could tell the difference between something animate and inanimate. That dog was somewhere between the two. Drawn as she was to the inexplicable, she'd rescued it from the beach and installed the girl who'd found it at the guest house she was favouring with her custom. She'd hoped the dog was merely unconscious and would wake at some point, but she feared it would not. Under normal circumstances, the creature would either get better or it would die, but this one did neither. Not unless it could be dead but still breathing. It was as if the clockwork were still turning, but the hands had fallen off. Grammer stopped walking and looked down at the steaming bundle in her hands. She hadn't remembered going into Harry's fish shop. She heard the familiar squealing of a poorly lubricated sign and knew she'd somehow arrived back at her guest house. "That'll do, feet," she muttered. The door opened before she could knock. "Oh, hello, cock." "At last," said a relieved voice from the threshold. "Right worried we were. Our Barry was about to send out a search party. Although who he'd have roped into that, I don't know. He's a mystery, that lad, and a worrier. That's why we love him, innit?" Grammer muscled her way into the warm, brightly coloured hallway. "Oh, you don't need to worry about me, our Kevin. It were only the sea." "Well, I know that, our Grammer. But Baz, he doesn't think the sea should be messed with. He thinks it's dangerous, you see." Kevin, short, long, wiped his hands on his floral pinny and pointed into the sitting room. "Do you want a brew, or are you going to have your supper in your room?" "Oh, I'll go upstairs if it's all the same to you." Short's face darkened just a little. Grammer smiled. "Don't worry, I won't sit on the bed, and I'll leave my teeth in." The old woman climbed the stairs. Halfway up she turned. "Oh, and Barry's right. The sea's dangerous. Only, you see, I'm dangerouser. I'll see you later, cock." Well, if that didn't prove it, nothing would. Grammer sat on the bed, waving a handful of warm scraps under the nose of the little dog, and it didn't stir a muscle. Grammer sighed, shoveled the scraps into her mouth, and chewed. There was nothing quite like the prickly feeling of fried batter and potato bits massaging your gum. "I didn't expect it at work, but it were worth trying," she said, showering Kevin's prize eiderdown in greasy slobber. "I know," said the little girl from her cushion on the floor. "I've tried all sorts to rouse him. I even whispered meow in his ear." "That were a good idea, Mary Ann, but I think we have to accept he's not coming back, lass." The little girl, on whom the dictionary definition of waif might have been based, wiped her eyes with the back of a dirty hand. "What are we going to do?" "We're not going to do nothing," said Grammer. "It's time you went home. There's nothing you can do for the little dog now. You leave him to me." "You're not going to give him to the sea, are you?" Beneath the grime, the girl's face went white, probably. Grammer shook her head. "No, I aim to get to the bottom of this before I decide what to do with him." Mary Ann got up. "Well, I'm sorry," she said before turning to go. "Hold on, missy. You'd best have that wash before you go.
I did sort of promise young Kevin you'd clean yourself up when he agreed to let you come up here. Horror spread across the girl's grubby face, and she shook her head vigorously. Look, Grandma said, we'll just scrub the bits what's sure. That lad'll never check. He'd be too frightened of what he might find. Marianne relaxed a little and followed the old woman to the sink. Grandma filled the bowl with a pitcher and looked out of the window. Dusk was settling on the seaside town, and here and there candles were being lit. She plunged the girl's arm into the sink and began rubbing at the dirt with a flannel. By heck, I reckon this is ground in, lass. It took longer than she'd expected, but after half a bar of carbolic and a lot of scrubbing, Grandma pronounced the girl clean enough and dried her. Marianne looked out the window at the gathering darkness. You're not going out tonight, are you? The old woman stopped adjusting Marianne's sleeves so they covered the remaining dirt. Why'd you ask? Well, if you do, I hope you're not planning to go near the pier. The atmosphere cooled. Grandma considered being told not to do something as simultaneously a challenge and an insult. And why not? That were where the doggy was thrown into the sea. It's the fair. I don't go near it at night, neither do most locals. The girl shivered a little and cast a nervous glance in the direction of the pier, illuminated by bright torches and coloured candlelights. Grandma's eyes narrowed. Why is that, lass? Marianne wiped her cheek dry and dropped the soiled towel onto the bed. Well, for example, this used to be a right popular place for cock parties. For what? You know, when a lad's about to get married, his mates bring him to the seaside to mess about, said the girl. Marianne thought for a moment. I suppose they get cocky, hence the name. Grandma, who had momentarily frozen, reanimated with a smile. Yes, I imagine you're right about that. We call some piss-ups round my way, but it amounts to the same thing. But what's that got to do with the fair on the pier? Well, they don't come here very often any more. Seems word's got around. Word about what? Grandma, never the most patient of souls, was reaching her limit. Marianne scanned the room, before moving closer to Grandma.
The 100 mark wager, she whispered.
Look, lass, I'm a bit tired and me battered gristle is starting to repeat. If you don't get to the point pretty sharpish, there's going to be trouble. The old woman wagged an arthritic finger at the girl, who backed away. Sorry, Grandma, she said. There's this booth at the fair. You pay 5 marks to get in, and if you stay inside for 10 minutes, they give you 100 back. They say there's nothing that'll harm you, but no one's won the money yet. What's in the booth? Marianne shrugged. No one knows. We haven't been able to get any sense out of the lads that have tried it. Gibbering wrecks they were. None have ever come back, neither. Grandma sat on the bed and considered this. 5 marks? That's a lot of brass. But then I expect they think how fine it would be to start their married lives with a small fortune under the mattress. No wonder they keep coming here. Word gets around about the prize, and there's plenty of jack-the-lads who think nothing can scare them. Bloody idiots. The old woman lit a candle and handed it to the girl. Come on then, lass, let's be getting you home. It was dark on the landing, but halfway down the stairs she heard Kevin's voice from the master bedroom. What's that light? Is that you, Grandma? Grandma paused halfway down the stairs. Don't worry, lad, she said. It were only Marianne with a candle in her hand. They reached the hallway and, by the flickering light of the candle, unlatched the bolts and stepped into the night. Marianne lived on Slipshod Alley. Truth to tell, Grandma wasn't entirely happy leaving her there and shook her head as she watched the girl slip her way between the railings and through a basement window. Marianne had some talent, that was for sure, but she's insisted on returning to the slum she called home. The old woman had considered more than once whether to offer to take the girl back to her cottage in the Butterlins Mountains, but she wasn't sure whether the change of scenery would suit her. Somehow, Marianne was at home by the sea. Yes, she'd be better off apprenticed to a sea witch, though they, as a rule, tended to be fat, smelly, and to have more limbs than was good for them. Grandma picked her way carefully back to the main street beside the beach. A half moon flirted with insubstantial clouds as its reflection winked at it from the sea. She was glad of the light, as there was precious little illumination to help her navigate the broken cobbles aside from the occasional candle, optimistically shining from the shop windows along the seafront. Precious little light until she looked up at the pier, that is. Bloody hellfire, she said, as, pausing for a moment to look back along the street to where Kevin and Barry's guest house lay, her mind made itself up and she followed it. Grandma was a simple woman and she didn't like mysteries. Now, as well as the case of the dog with the missing brain, she had this carnival.
Something told her they were connected, though she couldn't see how, and she knew she was unlikely to work it out without having the dots connected for her. If only Jesse Hemlock were here. What would Jesse do? Grandma was pretty certain her sister witch would also be making her way to the carnival, but she'd probably have a plan. Known for her faggling was Mother Hemlock. The old woman was also nervous, just a little. She was happy enough to put the sea in its place, and the simple folk of her country were easy to understand and steer to the rightabouts. But whoever was fleecing these bridegrooms of their dowries had to be both cunning and terrifying. Grandma could manage one of these at a time, but not both at once, as a rule. And there was the matter of the 5 marks for entry. She only had 3 marks with her, and most of that was intended to pay Kevin and Barry for their hospitality. 5 marks was as much as a farm worker might earn in a year, and it would hurt her grievously to lose it, even if she could come by it somehow. But it would hurt more to turn away from the mystery and shuffle off like the meek old woman she certainly was not. Now she could hear organ music, automated by the sounds of it, and she found herself joining others on their way to the fair. By the time she reached the gate, she was part of, if not a horde, then certainly a throng with pretensions. A Cranitan stood beside the gate, slapping the head of its club lazily into the palm of its hand. Grandma tried not to stare, but she'd only encountered jungle trolls when travelling circuses had got lost on their way to somewhere more populous and ended up in the Butterlands. On those occasions, she hadn't got the impression they had a violent nature, but she was pretty confident this one knew what to do with the shaped branch she was casually brandishing. "All right, cock," she said to the Cranitan as she reached the ticket booth. The creature bent forward, wrinkled its bulbous nose and bared its fangs. But then it looked closer and saw for a moment what lay beneath Grandma's outer appearance, before shaking its head and directing its malevolent attention to the next person in the queue. The man behind the window looked from the troll to the little woman and then shrugged. He'd seen stranger things, although not recently. "One little old lady ticket," said Grandma, offering up a 10-penny piece, which the man took without looking before handing her a ticket and nodding to the boy on the gate to let her through. It was only as she disappeared into the crowd that he realised she'd got in for half the ticket price. His eyes narrowed at this injustice. After all, he and his comrades were the ones who were supposed to be doing the fleecing around here. Grandma chuckled. "Strike first." The old woman gazed around at the brightly lit sideshows. "I wonder where they get all the gas from," she thought. "Must cost a fortune. And the noise. 100 people in the confined space sounds like a dragon with indigestion. But with the organ music and the incessant crying of the stall holders, it was nothing short of a cacophony. Fortunately, Grandma was pretty deaf, so she breezed through the chaos in search of her favourite game. Footnote. Grandma had always believed that pleasure should come before, or instead of, business. Under a sign that proclaimed, "Hoop the ducks, everyone's a winner," the old woman considered her chances. She wasn't naive. She knew well enough that "everyone" meant the furtive little oik, who was, right now, watching her with hungry eyes. "Why not give it a go, me old love?" he said. 10 pence for 3 hoops. You only need to hoop 1 duck, and you can choose any prize on the stall. Get all 3, and you win the grand prize worth 20 marks. The charlatan pointed up to where a crystal box sat, containing what looked like a small duck made out of gold. Plate, probably, but doubtless worth a fair bit. "Oh, I don't know. I'll just watch this nice gentleman have a go first. Perhaps he can give me a tip or two," simpered the poor old girl. The man behind her puffed his chest out and handed over his money. Grandma watched as he took careful aim. It seemed hard to imagine he could miss. The ducks were just there, after all. But somehow he did. One instant a duck had been there, the next moment the hoop had bounced off its neck. Twice more the man threw the hoop, and twice more it impossibly missed. The man watched the last hoop sink to the bottom of the murky pool. "It's a fix!" he shouted, shaking a fist at the diminutive stall holder. The sucker turned to check that his girlfriend was watching this bravado. When he turned back, he found himself face to knuckles with a huge bald man, whose trembling muscles gave the distinct impression of being barely under control. Grandma watched as the punter pushed past her. "Lad," she whispered as he passed, "best you head home before you lose more than a few pennies.
The old woman thrust a thumb over her shoulder at a sign that read, in bright letters, The House of Fear, 10 minutes to win 100 marks. For a moment she saw anger in his eyes, before he looked more closely into her gaze and his features cleared. He nodded and pushed through the crowd that had gathered at the promise of a little light violence, and led his girlfriend towards the exit. Good lad, thought Grammer, there's hope for you yet. She stepped up to the side of the pool and looked into its depths. Yes, they obviously didn't clean it out very often. Good. I think I'm ready to give it a go, Grammer said in her best poor old lady voice, popping down 10 pence. The wolf in human form licked his lips and handed over the hoop, smiling. Here you go, love. Take your time, he said in a voice that had all the warmth of a snake sorbet. Grammer leant forward, taking all 3 hoops in her hand. Most of the violence-seeking crowd had remained, witnessing the humiliation of an old woman being a fair substitute for blood. And there was a murmuring as she took aim. Hold on, love, said the showman with a cruel chuckle. You don't throw them all at once. Grammer looked up. Listen, son, I do things me own way. I never listened when they told me you couldn't cook a cheese toastie in a steamer, and I ain't paying no heed now. Silence fell behind her as she took aim again. She could hear the stall holder shuffling from foot to foot. Nervous. Good. Now, she said. She visualized the seaweed at the bottom of the pool and brought it up to beneath the duck she was targeting. She threw the hoops and smiled as they landed perfectly on the neck of the surprised bird. The crowd exploded in cheers, which lasted all of 5 seconds. That was easy, said a man. Anyone could do it, Grammer smiled. But no one did, except me. Now I'll have my prize, if you please. The showman's features were frozen and pale.
But no one wins the grand prize, he squeaked.
Seems I just have, said Grammer and held out her hand.
That prize has been in my family for generations, ever since great-granddad Honest John brought it back from his journeys down south, sobbed the showman, tears running down his cheek.
The hired muscle knuckled forward and loomed over the old woman. I suggest you call King Kang off sharpish, Grammer said in a low voice, or I'll let slip that these here are flash ducks you've painted to look like cockle shells. You've trained them to zip out of the way at the last moment. At a mutter from the showman, the muscle retreated into the shadows. Grammer relaxed and the duck with the hoopla necklace started moving again as the seaweed fell away from its leg. Oh, and I'd get that pool cleaned out if I were you. Flash ducks are prone to viruses. The showman wiped his face, hardly seeming to hear her. Look, I'm not a cruel woman, lied Grammer. I don't want to deprive you of your family heirloom. Hope arose in the swindler's face.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Grammer smiled. You said the prize were worth 20 marks. I'll be happy with 10, and you can keep it. Now the showman's face was a complex mixture of relief and annoyance. 10 marks would wipe out his profits for the month. But there was more than one way to skin a banana, as his great-grandfather had said. She was, after all, only a little old lady, and it was a long trip back to the town in the dark.
All right, he said before disappearing into the booth. After much rummaging, he returned with a heavy pouch.
The old woman took it, judged its weight, and shook her head. I weren't born yesterday, she said. This is 0.5 mark short. Red-faced, the showman searched through his pockets until he found 5 10-penny pieces and dropped them in the bag. Grammer nodded. Tarcock, she said, and pushed her way through the crowd, which had, it appeared, now decided to try its luck. The old woman sighed. It seemed likely the showman would make back much of his losses this very night. With 10 marks in loose change weighing her down, Grammer resisted the temptation offered by Professor Dippy and his fly circus, the wonderful waxworks of the weird, and Rector Refractor's Hall of Mirrors. It was time to find out what the bloody hell was going on. So far, all she'd experienced was the normal charlatanship of the fair, but that couldn't explain what Mary Ann had described. Anger and embarrassment, they were standard fare at the fair, but memory loss and blind fear, that was a different matter. Grammer wasn't easily frightened. You needed to have wits in the first place before you could be scared out of them. But what she lacked in wits, she made up for in wiles. There was something out of the ordinary at the heart of all this, and she felt a chill in her soul as she approached the gaudy sign. Arriving at the booth, she looked up into a skeletal face, white skin pulled so tight that she could see his cheekbones dancing around as he spoke.
I think you might be lost, little lady, he said, pointing up at the sign.
Grandma shook her head. I can read, laddie. She reached into her pouch and counted out 5 marks, plonking them down on the worn wooden lip of the ticket booth. The white face creased into a grin as gloved hands swept the coins beneath the countertop.
If you insist,
he said,
it's just that you're not our usual clientele.
Ain't that the truth? A hint of uncertainty softened the face, and the smile faded.
Oh, but where are my manners? I am Mortok, and welcome to my fair.
Grandma thought for a moment. You're not from around here, are you?
You're a sharp one, and no mistake,
Mortok said, not noticing how the old woman's face darkened.
No, indeed. I hail from the ice kingdom of Bijammy Snowmore, far to the northwest.
Well, you wouldn't know it from your accent. You look like a jammy, but you talk like a soft southerner.
I was educated in Varma,
responded Mortok, running his hands over his mask-like skin.
Unfortunately, my learning came at a price.
Next time you go into warmer climes, remember, slippy, slappy, sloppy keeps your skin floppy, Grandma said with a smile. Mortok's face was even more immobile than usual.
I'll bear that in mind.
That's a good lad. Never too late to learn a lesson. Now, what exactly do I have to do to win the 100 marks? Mortok pointed to the door at his right. It was set into a huge canvas marquee that completely sealed off this end of the pier.
It's simple enough. Go through that door and come out the other one.
Grandma nodded. Is that it?
There is one complication,
Mortok said, his skin stretching like old leather.
You cannot exit until the bell tolls. There is a gate inside that uses a clockwork timer. It will swing open when your 10 minutes is up. If, however, you want to be let out early, simply scream.
Mortok watched with satisfaction as the colour drained from the old woman's face. That would teach her to give him lip. He'd be surprised if she lasted a minute. Truth to tell, Grandma was rattled. Mortok was a pro. That was evident, with a heart as stony as his skin. And he'd successfully ripped off bridegrooms for years without ever being caught. All this suggested more than just cheap tricks and grease paint. But then Grandma was no ordinary punter, and like as not, she would be able to deal with whatever was behind the door. Like as not. The old woman shuffled towards the entrance. She'd intended to fool Mortok into thinking she was truly scared, the better to lull him. But she found she wasn't in fact having to try too hard. Her false teeth rattled as she placed her hand on the doorknob.
If I break my ivories, there'll be hells to pay, she chattered.
She turned the knob, which, true to cliche, made a grinding noise. The hinges creaked naturally as the door swung open onto a dark corridor, illuminated by nothing more than a couple of lamps hanging from the canvas roof. She had to give it to Mortok. He was a real showman. Once she was completely inside, the door was wrenched backwards before Mortok's face appeared in the gap between door and jamb.
10 minutes,
he said before closing it. Grandma fought to control the feeling of confinement. She'd always regarded claustrophobia as a pretty poor excuse for not doing a day's work down the mine, but here in this enclosed dark corridor, she could almost feel the walls constricting. Oh, get a grip, she said out loud. You've been in tighter scrapes than this before, and all you've got to do is scream to get out. An image popped into her mind of a grinning Mortok as he opened the doors to let her escape. No. While she didn't like it in here, she preferred it to the humiliation of letting someone get one over on her, especially that ghoul outside. Talking of which, she had considered whether Mortok might employ ghouls to scare people. But the average bridegroom would be pretty inebriated by the time he rolled up to the pier. And in that sort of a state, ghouls are barely visible, since they only operate on the rational mind. The more spirits you drank, the less spirit you saw. No, ghouls would not do. And, anyway, they were smelly bastards, so it'd be hard to keep the stench inside. Grandma could hear nothing but the muffled soundtrack of punters being divested of their loose change. Inside the House of Horrors it was almost silent, the air thick with dust. She stepped forward and immediately back again as a deck board creaked beneath her feet. Tutting to herself, she pressed on. In church and chapel, let it rackle, she said, quoting the dearly departed Arthur Tickle's favourite saying out of context. Her eyes were adjusting to the light now, and she could see that the corridor ended just up ahead, and she could also see herself. What's this? She asked herself as she examined the tall, ornate mirror hanging in the wall. The old woman froze as a deep, malevolent voice echoed along the corridor.
I am the Mirror of Og.
The letters O, G and E engraved themselves on the mirror's surface as it spoke. She straightened up in the silence.
Og? What sort of a name is that?
I show you as you truly are, if you dare to look,
continued the voice.
I said, whoever heard of a mirror called Org?
There was a rumbling from behind the wall before the voice spoke again.
Do you dare to look?
Grandma paused for a moment's reflection.
I don't think I'll bother if it's all the same to you. I know what I look like, a little old lady.
Ah, but is that what you actually look like? Don't you want to know how other people see you?
Not particularly, said Grandma. I know what they see, a little old lady. Now, what's this with your name, Org?
This time the rumbling was louder.
It's not Org, it's Og.
That's what I said, Org. But I still don't understand. What's this all about?
Listen,
sighed the mirror.
I don't make the rules. But look, see, you have to look. See yourself in the mirror. Or I can't let you through.
Grandma thought for a moment.
Oh, all right. I'm not going to let a poncy mirror stop me.
Then step forth, brave soul, and see yourself for what you truly are,
boomed the voice. The old woman approached, and then she saw herself. A chilling scream filled the corridor. But Grandma didn't make the noise. It emanated from behind the mirror, which now swung back and forth on its hinges, the scream oscillating as it did so. After a moment's hesitation, Grandma, relieved for once that she was deaf, stepped towards the hole in the wall behind the mirror, which had now come to a stop like a door ajar. As she passed the back of the mirror, she looked through at the reversed engraved word and muttered, "Smart ass," before clambering through. There was a small chamber behind the mirror lit by nothing more than a dim green glow that seemed to come from the walls themselves. As Grandma edged towards its centre, she caught glimpses of reflections bouncing from puddles and the impression of ancient flagstones. The air was chill, and the only sound was the drip, dripping of water leaching through from above. "Where the bloody hell is this?" she muttered. Then she noticed a quiet sobbing from the far corner, and as her eyes adjusted to the deeper dark, she made out a shape, oscillating. Cock? The shape stopped shaking for a moment, before the sobbing resumed with renewed gusto. Grandma knew that she should at this point be frightened. She was in a strange place in the centre of the House of Fear with no way of escape. It should be right about now that whatever had scared all the other punters should be trying to do the same to her. And yet she felt nothing but pity for whatever was hunched in the corner. She made a decision, stepped into the corner, and went to put her hand on what she assumed to be the shoulder of the shape.
"No, please don't hurt me,"
whispered the mirror's broken voice. That stumped the old girl.
"Now why would I hurt you, cock?"
"I saw what you saw," it said. "I know what you are."
"So? I know I am too, a little old lady."
The head of the shape shook.
"You are an elemental."
Grandma shrugged. "Oh yes, that too."
"You have been sent to destroy me. All the bad things I've done, all those people I've scared out of their wits."
"Oh, so it was you then."
The shape seemed to shrink as if cowering in the corner.
"I beg of you, don't harm me. I'm trapped here and have been forced to do it for so very long."
The old lady straightened.
"Well, that's as maybe, but we have choices, lad, and we have to accept the coincidences."
The shape in the corner sobbed for a moment before freezing.
"Do you mean consequences?"
it said before it could help itself.
"That's what I said," she responded. "Now, I'm fed up of grubbing around in the dark, so I'm going to make a little light."
"No!" screamed the shape. "If you use magic, he will know. He will punish me."
There was a rasping sound and light erupted.
"Magic, you daft apith! I brought matches and a little candle. Now, turn round, lad, and let me see you."
Oddly, the light of the candle didn't make the shape in the corner any more distinct. It only illuminated the fact that whatever was squeezing itself into an ever smaller space was hardly there at all.
"I cannot face you."
"Oh, there's no need to be shy," Grandma said, "but at least tell me your name so I know what to call you."
The shape stopped rippling.
"I'm called Bajar."
"And you're a demon, aren't you, cock?
There was a movement from the top of the shape that looked like nodding. Grandma regarded the corner sagely. There was certainly an indefinite humanoid shape, but it looked as though it was full of holes, like an old cloak that's on the brink of falling apart entirely.
"You don't look very well, Bijar. Are you ailing for summat?"
"I was wounded when Mortok caught me and bound me to this place," Bijar said into the corner.
Grandma looked around at the slabbed floor and dark, dripping brick walls.
"It seems to me we're not in canvas anymore," she said.
"This is a tiny corner of my world, the dungeon dimension. The mirror is the portal between worlds. I'm trapped here, surrounded by this foreign universe, and it's tearing me apart."
"So I see. Seems to me there's not that much left of you."
Bijar shook his head.
"This is my final season. Every day here I lose a little more of myself. Soon I will be rags in the breeze, and then, perhaps, that is what I deserve."
"Oh, don't be so maudlin," Grandma said. "Just tell me how you scared those lads."
"It was easy enough. The mirror softened them up. It shows you who you really are, deep down, and with nothing to protect you. The last thing an inebriated young man wants to see on the eve of his wedding is his true self, alone and unprotected."
Grandma nodded. "And then they walks in here and you do what?"
"I show them who I really am," he said, and turned slowly to look at her.
The old woman forced a scream down as she looked into a face born of nightmares. The mouth was a massive well of slowly rotating fangs, the lips cracked and weeping blood. She could feel her mind being drawn to the giant maw, an irresistible force imploring her to let go and to fall into the red, black and white tunnel that led to oblivion. Something was moving about in those depths, something with 4 feet. She forced her gaze up and focused on the nostrils, hairy, wide, bloody, and then felt the pull again, as if something was trying to shove her inside. Grandma resisted with all her will. She groaned, gritted her teeth, and desperately tried to draw her gaze from the black hole in the centre of the face. For a moment she pulled away, and in that instant looked up and into Bijar's eyes. Brown, bloodshot, and almost human, tears gushing away. She let the scream out, but not in fear. She let it go because there was too much to hold back.
"I see you, lad. I see you," she said.
It was the smell of raspberries that woke Grandma up. She snorted, sniffed, and sat up to find a plate of jam toast hovering under her nose.
"Oh, thank heavens for that," said Kevin. "I thought you might have croaked it in the night. You looked half dead when you got in."
The rusty cogs in Grandma's brain began turning. Oh, yes, she'd left the fair in a hurry, too fast to see the, no doubt, smug look on Mortok's face as she asked for the door to be opened. She had, after all, screamed. But she hadn't felt fear, just devastating sadness. When she dragged her gaze from the awful maw, which opened like the mouth of an anglerfish, except with the lure inside, she had indeed seen the real Bijar. Not the monster disguise that he wore, convincing though it was, but the soul behind the eyes. A soul in an agony of guilt and pain, in a wretched body that barely existed. No wonder it drove the punters out of their minds. It was like opening a gift box and finding yourself staring into the face of death herself. Blindingly dark, and totally overwhelming. Luckily for Grandma, her little mind was made of the sort of iron self-assurance that leaves no gaps for existential assault. So all she felt was a supreme pity for the poor creature, forced to reveal itself like a peacock, paid to parade till its tail fell apart. "Grandma?" The old woman snapped out of her thoughts and sniffed. "Oh, a nice brew. That's what I need. Thanks, Cock." When Kevin had left, Grandma sat back and chewed on her toast. Her ivory teeth remained in the jar by the bed, since they ruined all the fun. She remembered hurrying back, her mind spinning, and she knew she'd had an idea. And it had been a good un. It was something to do with the demon and the little doggy. Now, if only she could remember. After a few minutes of masticating, her jaw stopped moving. She looked out of the window and smiled. An hour later, as the mid-morning sun lit up the stained glass rainbow of Kevin and Barry's front door, Grandma hobbled down the stairs, called a farewell, and opened the door. Getting out of bed had been a triumph of will over rheumatism, but she'd been determined to act on her cunning plan before she either forgot it or saw some fatal flaw. This was a plan she was going to see through, and she was going to brook no arguments, particularly from herself. Grandma stepped onto the street and squinted up at the perfect blue sky. It was hard to feel miserable on a day like this, but she still felt the weight of that poor demon's plight on her soul. If all went well, she'd be helping more than one desperate creature by the time the day or night was over, but there was much to do. Grandma was exhausted by the time she arrived back at Kevin and Barry's that evening. She slumped into a chair at the dining table as Kevin fussed around her.
"Knackered, that's what you are," he said. "I told Barry, I said, that Grandma's chewing a banana from both ends, and soon enough there'll be nothing left of her."
The old woman said nothing. Kevin cracked first.
"Aren't you wondering what a banana is?"
"Not really, Cock." Kevin continued to chip away at the rock face of Grandma's disinterest.
"Well, our Barry thinks it's a kind of tropical fish, but I said to him, I said, that's a piranha, not a banana. I mean, after all, who'd chew a fish?"
The old woman said nothing.
"I'll fetch your supper. Meat and spud pie, it is."
Kevin sighed and moved towards the kitchen door.
"Anyway, I told him a banana's obviously a kind of cigar."
Grandma just caught Barry's deep voice echoing from the kitchen.
"And I said, that's a Havana."
A strong brew and Barry's hot pie revived the old girl a little, although her body would have given anything to slope upstairs and snuggle under the duvet with a bottle of stocky. But her soul couldn't bear the thought of one more night's torture for that creature on the pier. She popped her teeth out, laid them on the table, and tucked into a big chunk of spotted prick covered in custard. Now had she thought of everything? She tracked down Mary Jane and told the girl to meet her outside Kevin and Barry's at sundown. She'd also had a long conversation with the sea. It had taken some time to explain her plan fully, elements being somewhat monolithic in their thought processes. But she'd finally got its agreement. Indeed, it seemed to her that the ocean had been keen to help. The waves had been positively frothing as she left the beach. Grandma cleansed her mouth with tea, reinserted her teeth, and went upstairs. She glanced out of the window at the lights of the fair on the pier and nodded. It was time. One last thing, though.
"Right, little puppy," she muttered. "Let's be off with you."
Grandma lifted the dog into her bag, pulled it over the shoulder, and headed down the stairs. Mary Ann was waiting outside.
"Hello, lass," said Grandma. "Here, you take the bag. It's too heavy for a little old lady like me."
The girl smiled.
"Of course, but I wish you would tell me what you're planning."
They headed off along the seafront road towards the pier.
"Never you mind, Mary Ann. If I'd faggled this right, I can save more than one life tonight."
Mary Ann fell into step beside the old woman as they moved unnoticed through the twilight streets. As they walked, more and more people emerged from side streets until, by the time they reached the gates and the Cranatan, they were again enthronged.
"Right, you give me the bag," said Grandma, grunting as she took the weight of the hidden dog. "Remember what you have to do now. I'm depending on you, Mary Ann."
The girl nodded.
"I remember, but just you be careful, Grandma. I've heard terrible things about this fair and the man what runs it. Some say he's a ghoul."
"Oh, he's no ghoul," Grandma said, "though his heart is as black as one. He's as human as you and I, and it's time he was brought to account." The old woman turned and handed her entrance to the ape on the gate and disappeared into the punters. Mortock was surprised to see her. She could tell from the way his skin went taut before creasing into an inauthentic smile.
"Bet you didn't think I'd be back for more, did you, Cock?" she said, plopping the other half of the previous night's winnings on the table.
"In fact, little lady,"
Mortock said,
"you're the first person who's ever come back. I'm not sure it's entirely in the rules, nor am I quite sure how you've come out of the experience so very unscathed."
Grandma laughed and raised her voice. "Ah, afraid of a little old lady, are you? Can't be that scary inside, can it, if you won't let a little old lady have another go?"
Reflexively, Mortock went to put his hand over her mouth, but stopped himself just in time.
"Well, I expect we can make an exception in your case, madam,"
he simpered, waving her towards the entrance to the marquee.
"Same rules as before, though, and I'm not sure it'll be any less scary this time."
"We'll see about that," Grandma replied.
The old woman picked up the bag in one smooth motion and was through the door before Mortock thought to ask her what it contained. Time was now short. Grandma knew that once he'd had time to reflect properly,
There was every chance that Mortock would suspect something, barge in here and ruin everything. So she hurried to the mirror and knocked on it. A deep, uncertain voice said,
"Who's there?"
"A little old lady."
"A little old lady who?"
"I didn't know you could yodel, lad." Footnote. Sometimes, however dire and urgent the situation, you just have to see the joke through.
Is that you, Grammar?
Said the voice. Any portentousness it might have had swept away in the cause of comedy. "Yes, Cock. Now wind the mirror back. We haven't got long," she said, before stepping through into the demon dimension. Bijar sat in the far corner as before, although Grammar thought she could dimly make out footprints where he'd run across the floor to hide. As before, his face was in shadow, something Grammar was grateful for. The old woman crouched beside the shape and reached out. As her hand touched the shoulder, she felt a shiver and had the impression that, if she pushed just a little harder, her hand could pass right through the demon. "Now then, lad, we both know you're in a bit of a state," she said. "I can't see you lasting more than a few weeks. You're wasting away, losing a little bit of who you are with every set of wits you scramble." Bijar sobbed quietly. "There, there. But I'm going to ask you something now, and it's very important you tell me the truth. Right, lad?" She could see him nodding and pressed on. "I have a feeling that a little doggie strayed in here a few days back. Is that right?" The demon's body froze before collapsing in on itself even further.
"Yes,"
Bijar hissed between the sobs. "And knowing that you're lonely, I expect you thought he might make company for you, and that you couldn't hurt him on account of dogs having no wits to start with." More sobs, more nods. "I don't blame you. Who wouldn't want a friend when they're so alone?" the old woman continued. "But you don't know dogs very well, lad, because they do have minds. Different to humans, certainly, though not as different as some men would like to think. But they have minds, and this little doggie lost his when he looked at you."
"Yes," Bijar said. "I'm sorry. I did not know. And then Mortock found his body and punished me. I don't know what happened to the poor thing."
Grammar smiled. "I do, lad. He's here." The shape swung round so fast that Grammar barely had time to look down at the flagstones on the floor. She could dimly see the demon's maw reflected in the damp floor as its eyes scanned the room. She opened the bag at her feet, and there was a howl of grief as Bijar recognised the dog. "Now stop mothering," she said. "We don't have long before that devil outside comes rushing in, along with that brute he keeps to rough up little old ladies like me. But it seems to me we have an opportunity here to do two good deeds. Maybe three."
"What do you mean?"
Grammar risked a sideways glance at the creature next to her. He was looking down. "Good. Well, here we have a living body without a mind, and you, lad, are a mind without a body." Bijar said nothing. The only sound was the dripping of water and, Grammar thought, perhaps raised voices outside.
"You want me to possess this dog?"
"Good," he understood. "Sort of, though there's no mind to take over. You're really just moving into residence."
"Would I still be me?"
Grammar nodded. "I would think so, though I'd imagine as a demon you'd know more about it than me.
And I'd be able to leave this cell and live in your dimension?"
The old lady smiled. "Yes, lad. You could come home with me if you like. Though we'll have to change your name. I can't call you Bijar." There was a call from the other side of the mirror and the sound of fists beating on it.
"Open up!"
"Bugger," said Grammar. "Lad, it's now or never." Without hesitating, Bijar reached down and put his claws around the unresponsive body. He grunted as he lifted it towards him, fighting to keep his insubstantial arms together long enough to bring the dog to his chest and fall backwards. The mirror smashed and muscled arms appeared in the widening gap. Grammar looked at the floor where the demon had collapsed. "Lad," she said, and then she saw it. The rags that were the only remnant of Bijar's former form were moving. She dug amongst them and felt fur and a moving, living body beneath. "Come on, then." And she lifted the dog back into the bag where it lay. It was barely responsive, but it was alive, really alive, for the first time since it had last been in this chamber. Now for the bit she'd really been looking forward to. "Right, you lot, you've had this coming to you," she said, before whispering some words of command under her breath and approaching the huge brute in the mirror doorframe. She could hear cracking as the pier deck planks began to move, buckling and tearing one against the other.
The thug stepped back into the corridor, and Grammer could see Mortok behind, exhorting him to attack. She grabbed one of the lamps, pulled the candle out, and spoke a word to it, causing the feeble flame to erupt like a torch. "This is the end for you," she said, "and if I ever catch sight of your ugly white face again, or if I ever hear of you mistreating anyone, all the leathering you will get." Grammer reached up with the torch, and the canvas roof caught alight instantly. Mortok and the brute ran for their lives as the deck planks started moving and a great hole appeared in the decking at the old woman's feet. Without looking down, she dropped through and landed with a grunt in the boat below. Marianne took the bag containing the now very animated dog from her. "Right, see? Get me back to the land," shouted Grammer over the sounds of fire and pandemonium above. The sea obliged, taking them smoothly back to the beach opposite her guest house and waiting politely as the old woman and girl scrambled out. It was dark, the only light coming from the partially cloud-covered moon and the blazing marquee on the pier, as Grammer sat on the pebbles and caught her breath. "Well, that were bloody fun," she said after a moment or two. "I reckon that's the last we'll see of that white bugger. Now then, let's see about the little doggy." The old woman opened the bag and out jumped the dog, as full of life as if nothing had ever happened. She grabbed the little black terrier and held its head firm, looking into her eyes. "Are you in there, lad?" she asked. The dog barked. "Good," she said, putting him on her lap. "Now, you'll find that being in a dog-shaped mind will change you. But I reckon it's a whole lot better than the sorry excuse of a life you had before." The dog barked again. She let him go, and he scampered away, running in circles on the shingle, disappearing into the distance, only to reappear beside them before running off again. "He looks happy," said Marianne. Grammer smiled. "Aye, he'll discover soon enough that there's plenty of advantages to being a dog. I think he already is." Marianne pointed to the small form of the dog on the shingle, sitting still with one leg in the air and his head down. "Perhaps demons and dogs have more in common than I thought," said Grammer. "Leave off, Bijar. You might bite something delicate." "Badger? Is that what you're calling him?" Grammer thought for a moment. "I am now, lass. I am now." The little old lady sat on the beach and looked out to sea. "That'll do," she said.